Thank you for joining the Occupational Safety Leadership Podcast. This is episode number 139 with Sean Galloway. Sean is a repeat guest and the person that I go to when I really need help with how do I coach a difficult situation out there. So, Sean, if you could take just a couple seconds and kind of talk about your role and you've written a number of books. So you've done an awful lot of research on this topic.
Thanks. Yeah, I serve as the CEO of PROACT Safety. Our firm focuses on what we call the five core capacities for safety excellence. You have to build the capacity to achieve excellence, and that's making sure you have the right systems in place. And that's both on the preventative and the recovery side. So we could look at it and say, what are our preventative or corrective actions measured against the hierarchy of controls? How effectively are we managing risk out of the organization? And knowing deviations from expectations are occurring all the time. Mistakes are normal in complex environments. Do we realize it's not all about prevention? You have to have recovery mechanisms as well. So that's the system capacity. Leadership capacity, which is what we'll be talking about here today. But are we enabling our leaders to be effective in their role to where they're seeking out proactively those deviations before an incident or injury occurs and aligning people to those systems and providing the right degree of oversight and influence and coaching? Then are we creating the capacity for engagement? My latest book that will be published here in 2024 is this. The primary title is Shared Ownership. And I find that to be the final piece of real engagement, where it's not just I have a sense of ownership, we collectively have a shared sense of ownership. No matter what, we're all getting and helping each other get to the other side of this objective here, which of course is safety excellence. Then are we creating the cultural capacity? Every organization has a culture. Safety is a part of every aspect of a culture when you're excellent, but everybody has a safety culture, just may not be the one that you want. And then finally, we're creating the strategic capacity. So we're not just throwing a bunch of programs at problems, hoping the bad stuff goes away. We're actually targeting what we want. We're measuring what we want, not just trying to fail less. So that's what we focused on. And we do a lot of work in the leadership space to help enable what I find to be the most important people in the leadership ranks. And that's the most undertrained, under-resourced, and underutilized people in most organizations. And that's that frontline supervisor.
Yes. I have worked at a number of places that when I talk to the supervisor, not that the supervisor is really not trying to do a good job, but they just happen to be the person who was there the longest. And they said, well, we've decided that you're just going to be kind of that next person up in charge, you know? So I think that they're doing is the very best job they can. But many times they've never been trained in any aspect of safety except for small things like HAZCOM and confined space and lockout tagout. But the other part of it, that leadership part, you know, the part that you're holding people accountable, as opposed to, well, I just know when something's right and something's wrong, you know. So
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I had an article that just came out recently in Professional Safety, which is American Society of Safety Professionals magazine, and it was the 10 necessities, focus necessities for safety excellence. And two of them, to your point, are the competency of leadership acumen. So are we enabling our leaders to truly know how to get the best out of people, tap into that discretionary effort? And then are we also enabling with them the EHS competency, the technical acumen, not just our safety professionals, but do the supervisors have some basic, hopefully more understanding about risk exposure, OSHA 10, any of that type of stuff. And not a lot of organizations realize the leadership acumen piece and how strategically important it is, really, in any area of operations. And you're right, a lot of, if you remember the old Peter principle, that people kind of reach the point of where they start petering out of their capabilities because they were a super employee that became a supervisor. Or like what also I picked up on what you're saying, they were put into that role because of their technical expertise, but they don't really know how to get the best out of people. And it's one thing to be a subject matter expert in an area. It's a lot harder to be able to teach people how to also be that subject matter expert, or how to recognize different personalities or different strengths and weaknesses, and really get to know your people, which is such an important thing, investing in those relationships between supervisor and employee and really peer to peer, even the supervisor in the position above them.
Yeah. I know that when I was just a young bald faced boy, I thought I knew everything, and I could just walk in and say, hey, the following things are wrong, and it got done. But what I never really did for the first year or two was really establish those the relationships, really sit down, help to break down some barriers. There's always that commonality, you know. And as soon as I really started to focus on the soft skills, I really made a lot of progress a whole lot faster than just, I know right and I know wrong, and you're either doing right or either doing wrong then. So I wish that years and years ago that I had really focused on the soft side and not just, you know, I'm smart, so I can just say what's right and what's wrong.
You're right. I struggled with that as well when I was a supervisor, when I worked for Fleur Daniel. I had a military career, and then I worked for an engineering firm in England. Then I was recruited to come back to the States here, and I worked in their Sugar Land, Texas office. And I had a mentor, but it was more like a coach that I had, because the individual that I sought guidance from happened to be out at several of the projects that we were working in, specialty process engineering, a lot of chemical plants, refineries, petrochems. And I remember on soft skills, some feedback that he gave me one time. And I'm sure, knowing the gentleman, I'm sure it was delivered in a much more effective way. But what I remember is, Sean, you suck at giving feedback, particularly about positive reinforcement. And he gave me a little trick, and I've since heard of it from other sources, but I thought he invented this 20, 30 years ago. He said, what I want you to do is I want you to keep 6 pennies in your left pocket. This was back when people kept change in their pocket. And your job is to move a penny at a time to the right pocket, but you can't move it unless you've given sincere positive reinforcement to one of the crew. And there were a lot of days when I went home with 6 pennies in my left pocket, not because the crews weren't doing the right things or putting forth great performance. It was because I forgot or I got too busy. So I think developing those soft skills, you know, for some people, it comes natural, but for a lot of people, soft skills are pretty hard.
Oh, yeah. I think that I'm just now starting to get good at really sitting down and giving that feedback. And I think part of that feedback, of course, is that once that you know the person, you can really talk a lot more open, because you know, of course, about their family, you know, and everything else. And then it's a whole lot easier, as opposed to just somebody you happen to meet, you go by and you say, I don't even know what your name is, but I really want to tell you, you're either doing something good, something bad, whatever the deal is. That's really hard. And sometimes when I look at folks, it's almost like they really can't believe, like, I just don't even know them, but yet I want to tell them that they've done something good out there too. So
we have a workshop that it's probably one of our more successful workshops. We've deployed hundreds of organizations, called Leadership Safety Coaching. And a lot of companies will contact us for precisely the issue that you and I are talking about, helping those frontline leaders. But I generally will push back when the target is just the frontline leaders, because you can skill them up, you can enable them with success, increase the confidence, all that. And it can be undone by the experiences they have with the person to whom they report. So I always recommend that, you know, this has to be a change in leadership style or enabling of all leaders, because people pay attention to what their boss is paying attention to. And if it's not reinforced at that area, but we teach that there are 5 elements to coaching in this. And to reinforce what you're saying, the first one is familiarize, and that's getting to know your people, getting to know their preferred name. I worked with, I'll give you an example of a really successful individual that became the CEO of a big nuclear organization. And his first name professionally is Joseph. And I'm fortunate that he gave me some quick feedback, but in a couple of my initial calls when I started to work with the organization, I was calling him Joseph, and he said only his mom calls him back that. He goes by Joe. But had he not given me that feedback, I probably could have rubbed him the wrong way. So you got to know their, you got to know their people, their preferred names, their even their family members. And now that's not globally. Some countries this isn't as appropriate,
right?
But
if
you don't know the most important people to those individuals, you might create the impression you don't care enough about them. But then you've got to know their interests outside of work, so you can develop rapport. You're not just talking to them about work stuff. You got to know how best they learn and how best they communicate. Some people actually read emails. Can you believe it? That's that first piece is familiarize. So you got to know who your people are. You got to know what's important to them. And then after that, you've got to develop some sort of focus, because you can't coach your people for results, at least not ethically. You have to coach for the performance that leads to the results. Just like athletes, you can't coach on winning the game. You have to coach on the player's individual role and what they're doing to contribute to the successful outcome of the game. And then you got to go find. People do things for a reason, and it's not a matter of, you know, blaming. It's not a matter of just rewarding and recognizing. There are things that make it difficult, and there's things that make it possible to perform to the best of their ability. And a lot of those things are outside of that person's control, the environment, how the job is set up. An example I use about how the environment shapes behavior often is, you know, if you think about the first time you're going to meet your future spouse's or future partner's parents, you're behaving differently than if you're going out with your friends for dinner or a drink after work or something. So behavior is a product of the environment. You want to find, you want to, just as we're talking about, you want to develop skills around how to give feedback, both if you're getting what you want, but also if you're not. You have to have skills finally around facilitate, which from the Latin facile just means easy. How do we make it easy for our people to perform to the best of their abilities? And I wrote about it in the book that came out early in 2023 called Coach, a Safety Leadership Fable. And I wrote that actually to reinforce the hundreds of workshops that we've delivered, so we had another reinforcement mechanism. But I find, you know, leadership, of course, is situational, but I find the most effective style that if we can enable our supervisors or those crew leads is to be coaches, because we fall into that trap, all of us do, of managing by expectations, or we manage by exception, right? Because the 100,000 years ago, that rustle in that bush might have been something trying to eat us. The change in the color could have been an animal that's hunting us. So we're hardwired to look for the things that are out of place, address it until all's right in the world, and then nobody says anything. And that's why positive reinforcement is so elusive in a lot of organizations. And the dynamics of the workforce are changing. You know, the old joke was, I don't need to be thanked for doing my job, of some of the more experienced folks. Well, a lot of the folks, not everyone, not the stereotype, but a lot of the people coming into the workforce today, they want that type of recognition. They're seeking out that feedback. They want to know that what they're doing is appreciated and contributing to something. So we got to get better at meeting them where they are.
Yeah. So when you were talking, I had a flashback. I just cannot remember what year it was, but it was way back in like the probably about 94, about 95. And I went over to a crew, and I knew the crew pretty good. And I called a guy over to give him some really good feedback. And the first thing out of his mouth is, hey, you know, if you're going to correct me, it's supposed to be in private. You're doing this whole thing wrong. And I was like, no, it's good. You know, and this guy had literally almost, it felt like, had never heard good feedback ever. So to him, it was anytime that somebody talks to him, well, it's got to be bad. There's, you know, and that's what really made me sit down and say, God, I got to get better at doing feedback, because, you know, I can do what I think is a good job, and maybe I'm not doing a good job. I really got to practice, and then I got to get feedback from the person that I was given the feedback to, because maybe I think I'm communicating properly, and maybe I'm not at the same time.
There's an organization I was just doing an assessment, looking at their strategy, their systems, their culture, and everything, and they've got a long way to go, both from a environmental conditions and everything. And this is interesting. Some companies say we have to focus on the culture later. No, you look at Toyota, they focus on the culture before they open up operations or start to plan up. So it's always needing to be an aspect. And that's why I say for strategy, it has to be both on the injury prevention recovery and on the cultural side. But point is, they've got a long way to go from the foundation of safety they're needing to create. But what I found in their employee onboarding is they spend 20 minutes going over with the new employees how to receive feedback. People will talk to you about your safety performance. And I thought that was quite impressive because a lot of instruction and educations are on how to give feedback, but we're not also taught how to receive it. So you just triggered a memory with me. There was a plant in the southeast part of the United States, about a 1,000-person operation. Corporate felt the culture was going in the wrong direction. They wanted me to go in and take a look for some validation. And it was, particularly with how leaders talk to employees about performance in general. And I have led hundreds of these projects, but I'll never forget what this one lady said to me probably 12 years ago. We had a group, it was a union represented site. So I always interview by level. And I had a group of eight. It was United Steelworkers represented site. And we got on the topic in this focus group conversation about feedback. And my question, I'm paraphrasing, but my question basically was, what are the conversations like in safety? What do you all talk about? Well, in the South there, I can say, what do y'all talk about? So I can speak my native language there coming from Houston. But this is what this lady said to me verbatim when I asked what the conversations were like. She said, you know, in a few months, I'm going to retire after 30 years here. The only time they've ever talked to me about safety is when I've done something wrong. Just once before I retire, I wish they would tell me when I've done something right. And to your point, that culture wasn't used to any positive feedback whatsoever. And what's worse is that carried over into safety conversations. So safety conversations were something you avoid. Avoidance behavior is a real thing. We all do it to some degree because we're hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain. But if a conversation regarding safety is painful and people are avoiding that, how in the world do we improve? How do we get better? You don't. You stay stuck in this toxic environment, and unfortunately, it needed to change, and that's why they brought me in.
And those are really hard. I have worked with a couple of folks, and they wanted to change the culture, and they literally thought, oh, we'll have a class or two and everything will be better. The expectation is that if the culture is really ready to change, which means like management's putting in, of course, the time, the effort, and all that, that's typically about 1 to 3 years. And if they're really not into it, but into it enough, 3 to 5 years. So it can really take a long time for a culture to change. It's just not a, I did a class and everything's good. There's a lot of follow-up that has to happen to really make sure that culture sunk in and not just a, I listened to what somebody said, I implemented what somebody said, I really don't buy it. And I'll just go back to my own way of doing things, of course, again, in the future, you know. So
Yeah, when Terry Mathis, who's now retired from our firm, he was my partner. He was the founder of the firm. When we wrote our first book together, it was published in 2013 called Steps to Safety Culture Excellence. And we were looking at the average academic theory around culture change and the time horizon. And the average is about 10 years. But that's complete, you know, that's a 180 from one type of
Oh,
culture to
yes.
another. And like you, I've seen a really important behavior change within a few months to a year. And I've seen real substantive change over 3 years. Anything less than that, I always put into the camp of maybe that's Hawthorne effect. So I like to see sustainability, but you're right,
Exactly.
3 to 5 years. And when to your point, they want to move on to other things. Well, then I question if safety really is a core value, not a situational value, if it's not baked into a long-term strategic plan, and that safety strategic plan is baked into the business trajectory and growth plan, because otherwise they're going to be competing with one another, then safety is not really a core value. It's not that you have to keep throwing initiatives at it. That's certainly not what I'm saying, because more safety isn't always the answer. Better safety is the answer. And sometimes we need to stop doing things if they're non-value added, creating a false sense of security, or upsetting our customers and consumers of the safety improvement efforts themselves.
Right. I have heard folks say, like, oh, great, here comes another program, another system. And sometimes they kind of get systems mixed up, of course, when you think about the quality and the environmental, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Then with just the very couple of minutes that we have left, I'd like to talk about the different systems out there, because I really think everybody already has a safety system. You know, you might have a good one, might have a bad one. You know, the areas that have to be improved. So, is there any insight that you can do to kind of help folks to understand those things?
Plus, yeah, some organizations want to pursue like ISO, or they want to put like a VPP type of platform in place. But you're right, a lot of organizations have some sort of management system, whether it's informal or formal.
Right.
And it also depends on the maturity and the type of organization. Trying to put a rigid system in a kind of a homegrown type of environment isn't necessarily going to stick. So you have to look at where your culture's at, where your existing systems are. And then it's a matter of evolution versus revolution. And you're reminding me of one organization I was looking at, particularly around leadership and development, and they wanted to bring some of these things we're talking about here today to bear for the organization. And they found across the different divisions, it was a public utility, they were going about leadership development in so many different ways. And I ended up finding they had 52 strategic priorities throughout the organization. And that sounds crazy, but if safety has five, if occupational health has five, environmental has five, they all start adding up. So you have to look at collectively, what are we trying to accomplish? And are there common tools that can be leveraged? Like when we worked with a lot of pharmaceutical companies, product quality is consumer safety. So you don't have different approaches. They're all tied together. A lot of hospitals that I work with, safety began in the mid 80s as patient safety. I think 86 was the first time that was really used. And then it's moved to kind of contractor safety, visitor safety, employee safety, but they're all the same objective. And I'm a fan of looking within the organization, saying, what can we build off of? Because if you create that impression of more change, that can be a triggering of resistance, just the perception of more change. And I find the most effective way to minimize resistance to change is to minimize the perception of the change. So if you can say, we've accomplished this over here using these tools or these systems, why don't we leverage that over here? So then it's back to, well, this is evolution. We're just building on it versus we have to throw this away and start over. Change is the only thing that's constant in most organizations anyways. And a lot of people are in change fatigue or transitional confusion. And if we can minimize that and get people focused on the most important things to pay attention to, then we can move on. We continue to improve. And I find the better and better you get at safety, the more specificity is needed. You don't have as many low hanging fruits hanging out there. So you've probably, if you've been improving, you probably have some systems that are in place. And if they're informal, how do we make them a little bit more formal? Because if the individuals leading the informal leave, so might the systems.
Yes, exactly. Yep. So, Sean, we're just about out of time. I didn't get through at least a quarter of the things I wanted to talk about, because I just like to have that nice natural. We'll just talk, of course, you know. So, but with this last couple seconds, let the folks know how that they could find you, connect, and get any help if they need help out there.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm on pretty much every social media platform, so you can easily find me searching my name on LinkedIn. I have a newsletter as well that's called Maturing Safety Thinking, so you can subscribe to that. Connect with me on Facebook, X. I'm still trying to get used to calling it X instead of Twitter, Instagram, all those types of things. My company, though, is Proact Safety, so all one word. You can certainly find our website there, and all of our content, articles, blogs, videos, books, all that are on there. But most certainly, connect with me on one of the social platforms, and just like we did here, let's have a conversation.
Yeah. Fantastic, Sean. Thank you so much for all your time and your effort and for helping out the safety field. I look forward to any time that your article was out there to sit down and read it, digest it. And for my own selfish needs, I like to talk to you about things, of course, and really help out that safety field. So thank you so much, Sean. So
Thanks, David.
episode like number 139 where Sean Galloway is complete. Thank you for joining me. My name is Dr. David Ayers. Thank you and have a safe day.